and so they went, the bells in their hair ringing softly, while Danny settled down with a small band of survivors in the place they named Vase Toloro, the City of Bones. Day followed night followed day. Women harvested fruit from the gardens of the dead. Men groomed their mounts and mended saddles, stirrups, and shoes. Children wandered the twisty alleys and found old bronze coins and bits of purple glass and stone flagons with handles carved like snakes. One woman was stung by a red scorpion, but hers was the only death. The horses began to put on some flesh. Danny tended Sir Jorah's wound herself, and it began to heal. Ricardo was the first to return. Due south, the red waste stretched on and on, he reported, until it ended on a bleak shore beside the poison water. Between here and there lay only swirling sand, wind-scarred rocks, and plants bristly with sharp thorns. He had passed the bones of a dragon, he swore so immense that he had ridden his horse through its great black jaws. Other than that, he had seen nothing. Danny gave him charge of a dozen of her strongest men and set them to pulling up the plaza to get to the earth beneath. If devil grass could grow between the paving stones, other grasses would grow when the stones were gone. They had wells enough, no lack of water. Given seed, they could make the plaza bloom. Ego was back next. The southwest was barren and burnt, he swore. He had found the ruins of two more cities, smaller than Vase Toloro, but otherwise the same. One was warded by a ring of skulls mounted on rusted iron spears, so he dared not enter. But he had explored the second for as long as he could. He showed Danny an iron bracelet he had found, set with an uncut fire opal the size of a thumb. There were scrolls as well, but they were dry and crumbling, and Ego had left them where they lay. Danny thanked him and told him to see to the repair of the gates. If enemies had crossed the waste to destroy these cities in ancient days, they might well come again. If so, we must be ready, she declared. Jogo was gone so long that Danny feared him lost. But finally, when they had all but ceased to look for him, he came riding up from the southeast. One of the guards that Ego had posted saw him first and gave a shout, and Danny rushed to the walls to see for herself. It was true. Jogo came, yet not alone. Behind him rode three queerly garbed strangers, atop ugly, humped creatures that dwarfed any horse. They drew rein before the city gates, and looked up to see Danny on the wall above them. "Blood of my blood!" Jogo called. "I have been to the great city, Karth, and returned with three who would look on you with their own eyes." Danny stared down at the strangers. "Here I stand. Look, if that is your pleasure. But first tell me your names." The pale man, with the blue lips, replied in guttural Dothraki, "I am Pyat Pri, the great warlock." The bald man, with the jewels in his nose, answered in the Valyrian of the Free Cities, "I am Zaro Zon Daxus of the 13, a merchant prince of Karth." The woman in the lacquered wooden mask said in the common tongue of the Seven Kingdoms, "I am Quaith of the Shadow. We come seeking dragons." "Seek no more," Daenerys Targaryen told them. "You have found them." Eddard. The summons came in the hour before the dawn, when the world was still and grey. Alan shook him roughly from his dreams, and Ned stumbled into the pre-dawn chill, groggy from sleep, to find his horse saddled and the king already mounted. Robert wore thick brown gloves and a heavy fur cloak with a hood that covered his ears and looked for all the world like a bear sitting on a horse. "Up, Stark," he rode. "Up, up. We have matters of state to discuss." "By all means," Ned said. "Come inside, Your Grace." Alan lifted the flap of the tent. "No, no, no," Robert said, his breath steam with every word. "The camp is full of ears. Besides, I want to ride out and taste this country of yours." Sir Boris and Sir Merrin waited behind him with a dozen guardsmen Ned saw. There was nothing to do but rub the sleep from his eyes, dress, and mount up. Robert set the pace, driving his huge black destrier hard, as Ned galloped along beside him, trying to keep up. He called out a question as they rode, but the wind blew his words away, and the king did not hear him. After that, Ned rode in silence. They soon left the king's road and took off across rolling plains dark with mist. By then, the guard had fallen back a small distance, safely out of earshot, but still Robert would not slow. Dawn broke as they crested a low ridge, and finally the king pulled up. By then they were miles south of the main party. Robert was flushed and exhilarated as Ned reined up beside him.
"Guards," he swore, laughing, "it feels good to get out and ride the way a man was meant to ride. I swear, Ned, this creeping along is enough to drive a man mad."
He had never been a patient man, Robert Baratheon.
"That damnable wheelhouse, the way it creaks and groans, climbing every bump in the road as if it were a mountain. I promise you, if that wretched thing breaks another axle, I'm going to burn it, and Cersei can walk."
Ned laughed.
"I will gladly light the torch for you." "Good man," the king clapped him on the shoulder. "I've half a mind to leave them all behind and just keep going."
A smile touched Ned's lips. "I do believe you mean it."
"I do, I do," the king said. "What do you say, Ned? Just you and me. Two vagabond knights on the king's road. Our swords on our sides, and the gods know what in front of us, and maybe a farmer's daughter or a tavern wench to warm our beds tonight."
"Would that we could," Ned said. "But we have duties now, my liege, to the realm, to our children, I to my lady wife, and you to your queen. We are not the boys we were."
You never were the boy you were," Robert grumbled. "More's a pity. And yet, there was that one time, eh? What was her name? That common girl of yours, Becca? No, she was one of mine. God's lover, black hair and those sweet big eyes, you could drown in them. Yours was, Alina? No. You told me once, was it Meryl? You know the one I mean, your bastard's mother."
"Her name was Willa," Ned replied with cool courtesy, "and I would sooner not speak of her."
"Willa, yes," the king grinned. "She must have been a rare wench if she could make Lord Eddard Stark forget his honour even for an hour. You never told me what she looked like."
Ned's mouth tightened in anger. "Nor will I. Leave it be, Robert. For the love you say you bear me, I dishonoured myself, and I dishonoured Catelyn, in the sight of gods and men."
"Oh, gods have mercy, you scarcely knew Catelyn."
"I had taken her to wife. She was carrying my child."
"You're too hard on yourself, Ned. You always were. Damn it, no woman wants Baelor the Blessed in her bed."
He slapped a hand on his knee.
"Well, I'll not press you if you feel so strong about it. Though I swear at times you're so prickly you ought to take the hedgehog as your sigil."
The rising sun sent fingers of light through the pale white mists of dawn. A wide plain spread out beneath them, bare and brown, its flatness here and there relieved by long, low hummocks. Ned pointed them out to the king, the barrows of the first men. Robert frowned.
"Have we ridden on to a graveyard?"
"There are barrows everywhere in the north, your grace," Ned told him. "This land is old."
"And cold," Robert grumbled, pulling his cloak more tightly around himself.
The guard had reined up well behind them at the bottom of the ridge.
"Well, I did not bring you out here to talk of graves or bicker about your bastard. There was a rider in the night from Lord Varys in King's Landing. Here."
The king pulled a paper from his belt and handed it to Ned. Varys, the eunuch, was the king's master of whisperers. He served Robert now, as he had once served Aerys Targaryen. Ned unrolled the paper with trepidation, thinking of Lysa and her terrible accusation. But the message did not concern Lady Aerin. What is the source for this information? Do you remember Sir Jorah Mormont? Would that I might forget him, Ned said bluntly. The Mormonts of Bear Island were an old house, proud and honourable, but their lands were cold and distant and poor. Sir Jorah had tried to swell the family coffers by selling some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver. As the Mormonts were bannermen to the Starks, his crime had dishonoured the North. Ned had made the long journey west to Bear Island, only to find when he arrived that Jorah had taken ship beyond the reach of ice and the king's justice. 5 years had passed since then. Sir Jorah is now in Pentos, anxious to earn a royal pardon that would allow him to return from exile, Robert explained. Lord Varys makes good use of him. So the slaver has become a spy, Ned said with distaste. He handed the letter back. I would rather he become a corpse. Varys tells me that spies are more useful than corpses, Robert said. Jorah aside, what do you make of his report? Daenerys Targaryen has wed some Dothraki horse lord. What of it? Shall we send her a wedding gift? The king frowned. A knife, perhaps. A good sharp one, and a bold man to wield it. Ned did not feign surprise. Robert's hatred of the Targaryens was a madness in him. He remembered the angry words they had exchanged when Tywin Lannister had presented Robert with the corpses of Rhaegar's wife and children as a token of fealty. Ned had named that murder. Robert called it war. When he had protested that the young prince and princess were no more than babes, his new-made king had replied, I see no babes, only dragonspawn. Not even John Aaron had been able to calm that storm. Eddard Stark had ridden out that very day in a cold rage to fight the last battles of the war alone in the south. It had taken another death to reconcile them, Lyanna's death, and the grief they shared over her passing. This time, Ned resolved to keep his temper. Your Grace, the girl is scarcely more than a child. You are no Tywin Lannister, to slaughter innocents. It was said that Rhaegar's little girl had cried as they dragged her from beneath her bed to face the swords. The boy had been no more than a babe in arms, yet Lord Tywin's soldiers had torn him from his mother's breast and dashed his head against a wall. And how long will this one remain, an innocent? Robert's mouth grew hard. This child will soon enough spread her legs and start breeding more dragonspawn to plague me. Nonetheless, Ned said, the murder of children, it would be vile, unspeakable. Unspeakable? The king roared. What Aerys did to your brother Brandon was unspeakable. The way your lord father died, that was unspeakable. And Rhaegar? How many times do you think he raped your sister? How many hundreds of times? His voice had grown so loud that his horse whinnied nervously beneath him. The king jerked the reins hard, quieting the animal, and pointed an angry finger at Ned. I will kill every Targaryen I can lay my hands on, until they are as dead as their dragons, and then I will piss on their graves. Ned knew better than to defy him when the wrath was on him. If the years had not quenched Robert's thirst for revenge, no words of his would help. You can't get your hands on this one, can you? He said quietly. The king's mouth twisted in a bitter grimace. No, gods be caused. Some pox-ridden Pentoshi cheesemonger had her brother and her walled up on his estate with pointy-hatted eunuchs all around them. And now he's handed them over to the Dothraki. I should have had them both killed years ago, when it was easy to get at them. But John was as bad as you. More fool I.
I listened to him.
John Aaron was a wise man on a good hand. Robert snorted. The anger was leaving him as suddenly as it had come.
This Khal Drogo is said to have 100,000 men in his horde. What would John say to that?
He would say that even 1,000,000 Dothraki are no threat to the realm, so long as they remain on the other side of the narrow sea, Ned replied calmly. The barbarians have no ships. They hate and fear the open sea. The king shifted uncomfortably in his saddle.
Perhaps. There are ships to be had in the free cities, though.
I tell you, Ned, I do not like this marriage. There are still those in the Seven Kingdoms who call me a usurper. Do you forget how many houses fought for Targaryen in the war?
They bide their time for now, but give them half a chance. They will murder me in my bed, and my sons with me. If the beggar king crosses with a Dothraki horde at his back, the traitors will join him.
He will not cross, Ned promised. And if by some mischance he does, we will throw him back into the sea. Once you choose a new warden of the east, the king groaned.
For the last time, I will not name the Aaron boy warden. I know that boy's a nephew, but with Targaryens climbing in bed with Dothraki, I would be mad to rest one quarter of the realm on the shoulders of a sickly child.
Ned was ready for that. Yet we still must have a warden of the east. If Robert Aaron will not do, name one of your brothers. Stannis proved himself at the siege of Storm's End, surely. He let the name hang there for a moment. The king frowned and said nothing. He looked uncomfortable. That is, Ned finished, quietly, watching, unless you have already promised the honour to another. For a moment, Robert had the grace to look startled. Just as quickly, the look became annoyance.
What have I have?
It's Jaime Lannister, is it not? Robert kicked his horse back into motion and started down the ridge toward the barrows. Ned kept pace with him. The king rode on, eyes straight ahead.
Yes, he said at last,
a single hard word to end the matter. Kingslayer, Ned said. The rumours were true then. He rode on dangerous ground now, he knew. An able and courageous man, no doubt, he said carefully, but his father is warden of the West, Robert. In time, Sir Jaime will succeed to that honour. No one man should hold both East and West. He left unsaid his real concern, that the appointment would put half the armies of the realm into the hands of the Lannisters.
I will fight that battle when the enemy appears on the field, the king said stubbornly. At the moment, Lord Tywin looms eternal as Casterly Rock, so I doubt that Jaime will be succeeding any time soon. Don't vex me about this, Ned. The stone has been set.
Your Grace, may I speak frankly?
I seem unable to stop you, Robert grumbled.
They rode through tall brown grasses. Can you trust Jaime Lannister?
He is my wife's twin, a sworn brother of the King's Guard. His life and fortune and honour are all bound to mine.
As they were bound to Aerys Targaryen, Ned pointed out.
Why should I mistrust him? He's done everything I've ever asked of him. His sword helped me win the throne I sit on.
His sword helped taint the throne you sit on, Ned thought, but he did not permit the words to pass his lips. He swore a vow to protect his king's life with his own. Then he opened that king's throat with a sword.
Seven hells! Someone had to kill Aerys,
Robert said, reining his mount to a sudden halt beside an ancient barrow.
If Jaime hadn't done it, it would have been left for you or me.
We were not sworn brothers of the King's Guard, Ned said. The time had come for Robert to hear the whole truth. He decided then and there. Do you remember the Trident, Your Grace?
I won my crown there. How should I forget it?
You took a wound from Rhaegar, Ned reminded him. So when the Targaryen hosts broke and ran, you gave the pursuit into my hands. The remnants of Rhaegar's army fled back to King's Landing. We followed. Aerys was in the Red Keep with several thousand loyalists. I expected to find the gates closed to us. Robert gave an impatient shake of his head. Instead, you found that our men had already taken the city. What of it?
Not our men, Ned said patiently. Lannister men. The line of Lannister flew above the ramparts, not the crown stag. And they had taken the city by treachery. The war had raged for close to a year. Lords great and small had flocked to Robert's banners. Others had remained loyal to Targaryen. The mighty Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Wardens of the West, had remained aloof from the struggle, ignoring calls to arms from both rebels and royalists. Aerys Targaryen must have thought that his guards had answered his prayers when Lord Tywin Lannister appeared before the gates of King's Landing with an army 12,000 strong, professing loyalty. So the Mad King had ordered his last mad act. He had opened his city to the lions at the gate.
Treachery was a coin the Targaryens knew well, Robert said.
The anger was building in him again.
Lannister paid them back in kind. It was no less than they deserved. I shall not trouble my sleep over it.
You were not there, Ned said, bitterness in his voice. Troubled sleep was no stranger to him. It lived his lies for 14 years, that they still haunted him at night. There was no honour in that conquest.
The others take your honour, Robert swore. What did Targaryen ever know of honour? Go down into your crypt and ask Lyanna about the dragon's honour.
You avenge Lyanna at the Triton, Ned said, halting beside the king. Promise me, Ned, she had whispered.
That did not bring her back.
Robert looked away, off into the grey distance.
The gods be damned. It was a hollow victory they gave me. A crown. It was the girl I prayed them for. Your sister, safe, and mine again. She was meant to be. I ask you, Ned, what good is it to wear a crown? The gods mock the prayers of kings and cowards alike.
I cannot answer for the gods, Your Grace, only for what I found when I rode into the throne room that day, Ned said. Aerys was dead on the floor, drowned in his own blood. His dragon's skull stared down from the walls. Lannister's men were everywhere. Jaime wore the white cloak of the King's Guard over his golden armour. I can see him still. Even his sword was gilded. He was seated on the Iron Throne, high above his knights, wearing a helm fashioned in the shape of a lion's head. How he glittered!
This is well known, the king complained.
I was still mounted. I rode the length of the hall in silence, between the long rows of dragon skulls. It felt as though they were watching me somehow. I stopped in front of the throne, looking up at him. His golden sword was across his legs, its edge red with the king's blood. My men were filling the room behind me. Lannister's men drew back. I never said a word. I looked at him, seated there on the throne, and I waited. At last, Jaime laughed and got up. He took off his helm, and he said to me, "Have no fear, Stark. I was only keeping it warm for our friend Robert. It's not a very comfortable seat, I'm afraid." The king threw back his head and roared. His laughter startled a flight of crows from the tall brown grass. They took to the air in a wild beating of wings.
"You think I should mistrust Lannister because he sat on my throne for a few minutes? Eh?"
He shook with laughter again.
"Jaime was all of 17, Ned. Scarce more than a boy."
Boy or man, he had no right to that throne.
"Perhaps he was tired," Robert suggested. "Killing kings is weary work. Gods know there's no place else to rest your ass in that damnable room." And he spoke truly. "It is a monstrous, uncomfortable chair, in more ways than one."
The king shook his head.
"Well, now I know Jamie's dark sin. and the matter can be forgotten. I'm utterly sick of secrets and squabbles and matters of state, Ned. It's all as tedious as counting coppers. Come, let's ride. You used to know how. I want to feel the wind in me hair again.
He kicked his horse back into motion and galloped up over the barrow, raining earth down behind him. For a moment, Ned did not follow. He had run out of words, and he was filled with a vast sense of helplessness. Not for the first time he wondered what he was doing here and why he had come. He was no John Aaron to curb the wildness of his king and teach him wisdom. Robert would do what he pleased, as he always had, and nothing Ned could say or do would change that. He belonged in Winterfell. He belonged with Catelyn, in her grief, and with Bran. A man could not always be where he belonged, though. Resigned, Eddard Stark put his boots into his horse and set off after the king.
Reek. The rat squealed as he bit into it, squirming wildly in his hands, frantic to escape. The belly was the softest part. He tore at the sweet meat, the warm blood running over his lips. It was so good that it brought tears to his eyes. His belly rumbled, and he swallowed. By the third bite the rat had ceased the struggle, and he was feeling almost content. Then he heard the sounds of voices outside the dungeon door. At once he stilled, fearing even to chew. His mouth was full of blood and flesh and hair, but he dare not spit or swallow. He listened in terror, stiff as stone, to the scuff of boots and the clanking of iron keys.
No, he thought. No, please, gods, not now, not now.
It had taken him so long to catch the rat.
If they catch me with it, they will take it away, and then they'll tell, and Lord Ramsay will hurt me.
He knew he ought to hide the rat, but he was so hungry. It had been 2 days since he had eaten, or maybe 3. Down here in the dark it was hard to tell. Though his arms and legs were thin as reeds, his belly was swollen and hollow, and ached so much that he found he could not sleep. Whenever he closed his eyes, he found himself remembering Lady Hornwood. After their wedding, Lord Ramsay had locked her away in a tower and starved her to death. In the end, she had eaten her own fingers. He crouched down in a corner of his cell, clutching his prize under his chin. Blood ran from the corners of his mouth as he nibbled at the rat with what remained of his teeth, trying to bolt down as much of the warm flesh as he could before the cell was opened. The meat was stringy, but so rich he thought he might be sick. He chewed and swallowed, picking small bones from the holes in his gums where teeth had been yanked out. It hurt to chew, but he was so hungry he could not stop. The sounds were growing louder.
"Please, gods, he isn't coming for me," he prayed,
tearing off one of the rat's legs. It had been a long time since anyone had come for him. There were other cells, other prisoners. Sometimes he heard them screaming, even through the thick stone walls. The women always screamed the loudest. He sucked at the raw meat and tried to spit out the leg bone, but it only dribbled over his lower lip and tangled in his beard.
"Go away," he prayed. "Go away. Pass me by, please, please."
But the footsteps stopped just when they were loudest, and the keys clattered right outside the door. The rat fell from his fingers. He wiped his bloody fingers on his breeches.
"No," he mumbled. "No."
His heels scrabbled at the straw as he tried to push himself into the corner, into the cold, damp stone walls. The sound of the lock turning was the most terrible of all. When the light hit him full in the face, he let out a shriek. He had to cover his eyes with his hands. He would have clawed them out if he dared. His head was pounding so.
"Take it away. Do it in the dark. Please, oh, please." "That's not him," said a boy's voice. "Look at him. We've got the wrong cell." "Last cell on the left," another boy replied. "This is the last cell on the left, isn't it?"
"Aye," a pause.
What's he saying? I don't think he likes the light.
Would you, if you looked like that? The boy hawked and spat.
And the stench of him. Oh, I'm like to choke. He's been eating rats, said the second boy. Look.
The first boy laughed.
Yes, that's funny. I had to.
The rats bit him when he slept, gnawing at his fingers and his toes, even at his face. So when he got his hands on one, he did not hesitate. Eat or be eaten. Those were the only choices.
I did it, he mumbled. I did. I ate him. They do the same to me. Please.
The boys moved closer, the straw crunching softly under their feet.
Talk to me, said one of them.
He was the smaller of the two, a thin boy, but clever.
Do you remember who you are?
The fear came bubbling up inside him, and he moaned.
Talk to me. Tell me your name. My name, a scream caught in his throat.
They had taught him his name. They had.
Oh, they had.
But it had been so long that he'd forgotten.
If I say it wrong, he'd take another finger. Or worse, he'll...
He would not think about that. He could not think about that. There were needles in his jaw, in his eyes. His head was pounding.
Please,
he squeaked, his voice thin and weak. He sounded 100 years old. Perhaps he was.
How long have I been in here?
Go, he mumbled through broken teeth and broken fingers, his eyes closed tight against the terrible bright light.
Please, you can have the rat. Don't hurt me.
Reek, said the larger of the boys.
Your name is Reek, remember?
He was the one with the torch. The smaller boy had the ring of iron keys.
Reek, tears ran down his cheeks. I remember. I do.
His mouth opened and closed.
My name is Reek. It rhymes with leek.
In the dark he did not need a name, so it was easy to forget.
Reek, Reek, my name is Reek.
He had not been born with that name. In another life he had been someone else. But here and now his name was Reek. He remembered. He remembered the boys as well. They were clad in matching lamb's wool doublets, silver grey with dark blue trim. Both were squires, both were 8, and both were Walder Frey.
Big Walter and Little Walter, yes.
Only the big one was little and the little one was big, which amused the boys and confused the rest of the world.
I know you, he whispered through cracked lips. I know your names. You're to come with us, said Little Walder. His lordship has need of you, said Big Walder.
Fear went through him like a knife.
They're only children, he thought. 2 boys of 8.
He could overcome 2 boys of 8, surely, even as weak as he was. He could take the torch, take the keys, take the dagger sheathed on Little Walder's hip. Escape.
No, it's too easy. It is a trap if I run. He will take another finger from me. He will take more of my teeth.
He had run before. Years ago, it seemed, when he still had some strength in him, when he had still been defiant. That time it had been Cairo with the keys. She told him she had stolen them, that she knew a postern gate that was never guarded.
"Take me back to Winterfell, my lord," she begged,
pale-faced and trembling.
"I don't know the way. I can't escape alone. Come with me, please."
And so he had. The jailer was dead drunk in a puddle of wine, with his breeches down around his ankles. The dungeon door was open, and the postern gate had been unguarded, just as she had said. They waited for the moon to go behind a cloud, then slipped from the castle and splashed across the weeping water, stumbling over stones half frozen by the icy stream. On the far side, he had kissed her.
"You've saved us," he said. "Fool, fool."
It had all been a trap, a game, a jape. Lord Ramsay loved the chase and preferred to hunt 2-legged prey. All night they ran through the darkling wood. But as the sun came up, the sound of a distant horn came faintly through the trees, and they heard the baying of a pack of hounds.
"We should split up," he told Kyra, as the dogs grew closer. "They cannot track us both."
The girl was crazed with fear, though, and refused to leave his side, even when he swore he would raise a host of Ironborn and come back for her if she should be the one they followed. Within the hour, they were taken. One dog knocked him to the ground, and a second bit Kara on the leg as she scrambled up a hillside. The rest surrounded them, baying and snarling, snapping at them every time they moved, holding them there until Ramsay Snow rode up with his huntsman. He was still a bastard then, not yet a Bolton. "There you are," he said, smiling down at them from the saddle. "You warned me, wandering off like this. Have you grown tired of my hospitality so soon?" That was when Kyra seized a stone and threw it at his head. It missed by a good foot, and Ramsay smiled. "Oh, you must be punished." Reek remembered the desperate, frightened look in Kyra's eyes. She had never looked so young as she did in that moment, still half a girl, but there was nothing he could do.
"She brought them down on us," he thought. "If we had separated as I wanted, one of us might have gotten away."
The memory made it hard to breathe. Reek turned away from the torch, with tears glimmering in his eyes.
"What does he want of me this time?" he thought, despairing. "Why won't he just leave me be? I did no wrong. Not this time. Why won't they just leave me in the dark?"
He'd had a rat, a fat one, warm and wriggling.
"Should we wash him?" asked Little Walder. "His lordship likes him stinky," said Big Walder. "That's why he named him Reek." "Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with bleak." He had to remember that. "Serve and obey, and remember who you are, and no more harm will come to you. He promised. His lordship promised."
Even if he'd wanted to resist, he did not have the strength. It had been scourged from him, starved from him, flayed from him. When Little Walder pulled him up and Big Walder waved the torch at him to herd him from the cell, he went along as docile as a dog. If he'd had a tail, he would have tucked it down between his legs.
"If I had a tail, the bastard would have cut it off."
The thought came unbidden, a vile thought, dangerous. His lordship was not a bastard anymore.
"Bolton, not Snow."
The boy king on the Iron Throne had made Lord Ramsay legitimate, giving him the right to use his lord father's name. Calling him Snow reminded him of his bastardy and sent him into a black rage. Reek must remember that. And his name. He must remember his name. For half a heartbeat had eluded him, and that frightened him so badly that he tripped on the steep dungeon steps and tore his breeches open on the stone, drawing blood. Little Walder had to shove the torch at him to get him back on his feet and moving again. Out in the yard, night was settling over the Dreadfort, and a full moon was rising over the castle's eastern walls. Its pale light cast the shadows of the tall, triangular merlons across the frozen ground, a line of sharp black teeth. The air was cold and damp and full of half-forgotten smells.
"The world," Reek told himself. "This is what the world smells like."
He did not know how long he had been down there in the dungeons, but it had to have been half a year at least.
"That long or longer? What if it has been 5 years or 10 or 20? Would I even know? What if I went mad down there and half my life is gone?"
But no, that was folly. It could not have been so long. The boys were still boys. If it had been 10 years, they would have grown into men. He had to remember that.
"I must not let them drive me mad. He can take my fingers and my toes. He can put out my eyes and slice my ears off. But he cannot take my wits unless I let him."
Little Walder led the way with torch in hand. Reek followed meekly, with Big Walder just behind him. The dogs in the kennels barked as they went by. Wind swirled through the yard, cutting through the thin cloth of the filthy rags he wore and raising goose prickles on his skin. The night air was cold and damp, but he saw no sign of snow, though surely winter was close at hand. Greek wondered if he would be alive to see the snows come.
"How many fingers will I have? How many toes?"
When he raised a hand, he was shocked to see how white it was, how fleshless.
"Skin and bones," he thought. "I have an old man's hands."
Could he have been wrong about the boys? What if they were not Little Walder and Big Walder after all, but the sons of the boys he'd known? The great hall was dim and smoky. Rows of torches burned to left and right, grasped by skeletal human hands jutting from the walls. High overhead were wooden rafters black from smoke, and a vaulted ceiling lost in shadow. The air was heavy with the smells of wine and ale and roasted meat. Reek's stomach rumbled noisily at the scents, and his mouth began to water. Little Walder pushed him stumbling past the long tables where the men of the garrison were eating. He could feel their eyes upon him. The best places, up near the dais, were occupied by Ramsay's favourites, the bastard's boys. Ben Bones, the old man who kept his lordship's beloved hunting hounds, Damon, called Damon Dance for Me, fair-haired and boyish, Grunt, who had lost his tongue for speaking carelessly in Lord Roos's hearing, Sir Alan, Skinner, Yellow Dick. Further down below the salt were others that Reek knew by sight, if not by name, sworn swords and sergeants, soldiers and jailers and torturers. But there were strangers, too. Faces he did not know. Some wrinkled their noses as he passed, whilst others laughed at the sight of him.
"Guess," Reek thought, "his lordship's friends, and I am brought up to amuse them."
A shiver of fear went through him. At the high table, the bastard of Bolton sat in his lord father's seat, drinking from his father's cup. Two old men shared the high table with him, and Reek knew at a glance that both were lords. One was gaunt, with flinty eyes, a long white beard, and his face as hard as a winter frost. His jerkin was a ragged bearskin, worn and greasy. Underneath he wore a ringmail burnie, even at table. The second lord was thin as well, but twisted where the first was straight. One of his shoulders was much higher than the other, and he stooped over his trencher like a vulture over carrion. His eyes were grey and greedy, his teeth yellow, his forked beard a tangle of snow and silver. Only a few wisps of white hair still clung to his spotted skull. But the cloak he wore was soft and fine, grey wool trimmed with black sable and fastened at the shoulder with a starburst wrought in beaten silver. Ramsay was clad in black and pink, black boots, black belt and scabbard, black leather jerkin over a pink velvet doublet, slashed with dark red satin. In his right ear gleamed a garnet, cut in the shape of a drop of blood. Yet for all the splendour of his garb, he remained an ugly man, big bone and slope-shouldered, with a fleshiness to him that suggested that in later life he would run to vet. His skin was pink and blotchy, his nose broad, his mouth small, his hair long and dark and dry. His lips were wide and meaty, but the thing men noticed first about him were his eyes. He had his lord father's eyes, small, close-set, queerly pale. Ghost grey, some men called the shade. But in truth his eyes were all but colourless, like two chips of dirty ice. At the sight of Reek, he smiled, a wet-lipped smile. "There he is, my sore old friend." To the men beside him he said, "Reek has been with me since I was a boy. My lord father gave him to me as a token of his love." The two lords exchanged a look.
"I had heard your servant man was dead," said the one with the stooped shoulder. "Slain by the Starks," they said.
Lord Ramsay chuckled. "The iron men will tell you that what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger, like Reek. He smells of the grave, though, I grant you that."
"He smells of night soil and stale vomit."
The stoop-shouldered old lord tossed aside the bone that he'd been gnawing on and wiped his fingers on the tablecloth.
Is there some reason you must needs inflict him upon us whilst we're eating?"
The second lord, the straight-backed old man in the male burnie, studied Reek with flinty eyes. "Look again," he urged the other lord. "His hair's gone white, and he's 3 stone thinner. Aye, but this is no serving man. Have you forgotten?" The crookbacked lord looked again and gave a sudden snort.
"Him? Can it be? Stark's ward? Smiling? Always smiling?"
"He smiles less often now," Lord Ramsay confessed. "I may have broken some of his pretty white teeth." "You would have done better to slit his throat," said the Lord in Mayo. "A dog who turns against his master is fit for nought but skinning." "Oh, he's been skinned here and there," said Ramsay.
"Yes, my lord, I was bad, my lord. Insolent and—"
He licked his lip, trying to think of what else he had done.
"Serve and obey," he told himself, "and he'll let you live and keep the parts that you still have. Serve and obey, and remember your name. Reek, reek, it rhymes with meek. Bad and—"
"There's blood on your mouth," Ramsay observed. "Have you been chewing on your fingers again, Reek?"
"No, no, my lord, I swear."
Reek had tried to bite his own ring finger off once, to stop it hurting, after they had stripped the skin from it. Lord Ramsay would never simply cut off a man's finger. He preferred to flay it, and let the exposed flesh dry and crack and fester. Reek had been whipped and racked and cut, but there was no pain half so excruciating as the pain that followed flaying. It was the sort of pain that drove men mad, and it could not be endured for long. Soon or late the victim would scream, "Please, no more, no more! Stop it hurting! Cut it off!" And Lord Ramsay would oblige. It was a game they played. Reek had learned the rules, as his hand and feet could testify. But that one time he had forgotten, and tried to end the pain himself, with his teeth. Ramsay had not been pleased, and the offence had cost Reek another toe.
"I ate a rat," he mumbled.
"A rat?" Ramsay's pale eyes glittered in the torchlight. "All the rats in the dread fort belong to my lord father. How dare you make a meal of one without my leave?" Reek did not know what to say, so he said nothing. One wrong word could cost him another toe, even a finger. Thus far he had lost 2 fingers off his left hand and the pinky off his right, but only the little toe of his right foot against 3 from his left. Sometimes Ramsay would make japes about balancing him out.
"My lord was only japing," he tried to tell himself. "He does not want to hurt me. He told me so. He only does it when I give him cause."
His lord was merciful and kind. He might have flayed his face off for some of the things Reek had said, before he'd learned his true name and proper place. "This grows tedious," said the lord in the male burnie. "Kill him and be done with it." Lord Ramsay filled his cup with ale.
"That will spoil our celebration, my lord. Reek, I have glad tidings for you. I am to be wed. My lord father is bringing me a Stark girl, Lord Eddard's daughter, Arya. You remember little Arya, don't you?"
"Arya Underfoot," he almost said. "Arya Horseface.
Rob's younger sister, brown-haired, long-faced, skinny as a stick, always dirty."
"Sansa was the pretty one."
He remembered a time when he had thought that Lord Eddard Stark might marry him to Sansa and claim him for a son. But that had only been a child's fancy. "Arya, though,
I remember her, Arya.
She shall be the Lady of Winterfell, and me her lord.
She is only a girl." "Yes, my lord, congratulations."
"Will you attend me at my wedding, Reek?" He hesitated.
"If you wish it, my lord."
"Oh, I do." He hesitated again, wondering if this was some cruel trap.
"Yes, my lord, if it please you, I would be honored."
"We must take you out of that vile dungeon, then. Scrub you pink again. Get you some clean clothes, some food to eat, some nice soft porridge. Would you like that? Perhaps a peas pie laced with bacon? I have a little task for you, and you'll need your strength back if you are to serve me. You do want to serve me, I know.
Yes, my lord, more than anything.
A shiver went through him.
I'm your reek. Please let me serve you. Please.
Since you ask so nicely, how can I deny you? Ramsay Bolton smiled. I ride to Warwick, and you will be coming with me to help me fetch home my virgin bride.
Tyrion. The eunuch was humming tunelessly to himself as he came through the door, dressed in flowing robes of peach-coloured silk and smelling of lemons. When he saw Tyrion seated by the hearth, he stopped and grew very still.
"My lord Tyrion,"
came out in a squeak, punctuated by a nervous giggle.
"So you do remember me. I had begun to wonder."
"It is so very good to see you, looking so strong and well,"
Varys smiled his slimy smile,
"though I confess I had not thought to find you in mine own humble chambers."
"They are humble, excessively so in truth."
Tyrion had waited until Varys was summoned by his father before slipping in to pay him a visit. The eunuch's apartments were sparse and small. Three snug, windowless chambers under the north wall.
"I'd hope to discover bushel baskets of juicy secrets to while away the waiting, but there's not a paper to be found."
He'd search for hidden passages, too, knowing the spider must have ways of coming and going unseen, but those had proved equally elusive.
"There was water in your flagon, gods have mercy," he went on. "Your sleeping cell is no wider than a coffin. And that bed, is it actually made of stone, or does it only feel that way?"
Varys closed the door and barred it.
"I'm plagued with backaches, my lord, and prefer to sleep upon a hard surface."
"I would have taken you for a feather bed, man."
"I'm full of surprises. Are you cross with me for abandoning you after the battle?"
"It made me think of you as one of my family."
"It was not for want of love, my good lord. I have such a delicate disposition, and your scar is so dreadful to look upon." Ugh.
He gave an exaggerated shudder.
"Your poor nose."
Tyrion rubbed irritably at the scab.
"Perhaps I should have a new one made of gold. What sort of nose would you suggest, Varys? One like yours to smell out secrets? Or should I tell the goldsmith that I want my father's nose?"
He smiled.
"My noble father labours so diligently that I scarce see him any more. Tell me, is it true that he is restoring Grand Maester Pycelle to the small council?"
"It is, my lord."
"Do I have my sweet sister to thank for that?"
Pycelle had been his sister's creature. Tyrion had stripped the man of office, beard, and dignity, and flung him down into a black cell.
"Not at all, my lord. Thank the archmaesters of Old Town, those who wish to insist on Pycelle's restoration on the grounds that only the conclave may make or unmake a grand maester."
"Bloody fools," thought Tyrion. "I seem to recall that Maegor the Cruel's headsman unmade three with his axe."
"Quite true," Varys said. "And the second, Aegon, fed Grand Maester Gerardis to his dragon."
"Alas, I am quite dragonless. I suppose I could have dipped Pycelle in wildfire and set him ablaze. Would the Citadel have preferred that?"
"Well, it would have been more in keeping with tradition,"
the eunuch tittered.
"Thankfully, wiser heads prevailed, and the conclave accepted the fact of Pycelle's dismissal and set about choosing his successor." after giving due consideration to Maester Turquin, the Cordwain's son, and Maester Eric, the hedge knight's bastard, and thereby demonstrating to their own satisfaction that ability counts for more than birth in their order, the conclave was on the verge of sending us Maester Gorman, a Tyrell of Highgarden. When I told your Lord Father, he acted at once.
The conclave met in Old Town, behind closed doors, Tyrion knew. Its deliberations were supposedly a secret.
So Varys has little birds in the citadel, too.
I see. So my father decided to nip the rose before it bloomed.
He had to chuckle.
Pycelle is a toad. But better a Lannister toad than a Tyrell toad, no?
Grand Maester Pycelle has always been a good friend to your house, Varys said sweetly. Perhaps it will console you to learn that Sir Boris Blunt is also being restored.
Cersei had stripped Sir Boris of his white cloak for failing to die in the defence of Prince Tommen, when Bronn had seized the boy on the Rosby Road. The man was no friend of Tyrion's, but after that he likely hated Cersei almost as much.
I suppose that's something.
Blunt is a blustering coward, he said amiably. Is he? Oh dear. Still, the knights of the King's Guard do serve for life, traditionally. Perhaps Sir Boris will prove braver in future. He will, no doubt, remain very loyal.
To my father, said Tyrion pointedly.
While we're on the subject of the King's Guard, I wonder, could this delightfully unexpected visit of yours happen to concern Sir Boris's fallen brother, the gallant Sir Mandan More?
The eunuch stroked a powdered cheek.
Your man, Bronn, seems most interested in him of late.
Bronn had turned up all he could on Sir Mandan, but no doubt Varys knew a deal more, should he choose to share it.
The man seems to have been quite friendless, Tyrion said carefully.
Sadly, said Varys, oh, sadly. You might find some kin if you turned over enough stones back in the Vale, but here, Lord Aaron brought him to King's Landing, and Robert gave him his white cloak, but neither loved him much, I fear. Nor was he the sort the small folk cheer in the tourneys, despite his undoubted prowess. Why, even his brothers of the King's Guard never warmed to him. Sir Barristan was once heard to say that the man had no friend but his sword and no life but duty. But, you know, I do think Selby meant it altogether as praise, which is queer when you consider it, is it not? Those are the very qualities we seek in our King's Guard, it could be said. Men who live not for themselves, but for their king. By those lights, our brave Sir Mandan was the perfect white knight, and he died as a knight of the King's Guard ought, with sword in hand, defending one of the king's own blood.
The eunuch gave him a slimy smile and watched him sharply.
Trying to murder one of the king's own blood, you mean?
Tyrion wondered if Varys knew rather more than he was saying. Nothing he'd just heard was new to him. Bronn had brought back much the same reports. He needed a link to Cersei, some sign that Sir Mandan had been his sister's catspaw.
What we want is not always what we get, he reflected bitterly,
which reminded him.
It is not Sir Mandan who brings me here.
You can be sure. The eunuch crossed the room to his flagon of water. May I serve you, my lord?
He asked as he filled a cup.
Yes, but not with water.
He folded his hands together.
I want you to bring me Shay.
Varys took a drink.
Is that wise, my lord? the dear, sweet child. It would be such a shame if your father hanged her.
It did not surprise him that